Hello everyone, my name is Ryan and you are listening to the Vegan Report. Today we are starting the new year strong, discussing the undercover reporting of Unparalleled Suffering. Unparalleled Suffering is a photographer, filmmaker and writer whose footage of animal abuse is widely spread. Your favorite vegan influencer, farm sanctuary or animal rights organization has most likely used his content at one point or another, since it is top-notch quality and freely available for non-commercial use on unparalleledsuffering.org. Let me add two things before we get to the episode. First, we are protecting his identity. You will not know his name, which I don't know by the way, or see his picture. Being anonymous is essential to his work, and I highly, highly respect that. And secondly, in this conversation, we talked about slaughterhouses, and Unparalleled Suffering forgot to mention something he investigated called custom slaughterhouses. Now, you need to hear the crazy stories he shared about those. You will find them in a bonus episode I published at the same time as this episode. So I felt like we should start the conversation by talking about the anonymity aspect of Unparalleled Suffering, because you erase your presence from, you know, your initiative, from your project, from your platform. Why is it important to, you know, be absent, not to put your name out there? And is it hard, you know, to keep that anonymous and undercover and to erase your presence?
Yeah, so I have to be anonymous as much as possible. It's pretty much impossible in this day and age to be absolutely perfect about it 24/7. You know, mistakes happen here and there, but you know, I try to control it as best as I can. And well, I do a lot of undercover work, not all the time. It's not like my full-time jobs per se, although it was full-time as possible for several years in a row. But yeah, if people were to know my identity, there's a lot of stuff that I've covered in the past and intend to cover in the future that would just be absolutely impossible, as far as even, you know, gaining access and getting permission to do certain things. So sometimes, you know, I could document something where I don't really have to have any kind of one-on-one conversation with someone and nobody has to hear my name or interact with me in any way. And in that kind of scenario, like for example, if I just decided to attend a livestock auction, it doesn't really matter as much. But for when I document certain things, such as a very small family farm, for example, where I'm talking to the owner of the operation and I'm getting access to record very intimate things, such as them killing animals and chopping up their body. If they were to know who I was, I would never be able to get permission to even be on their property to begin with. And not only that, but in certain cases, they would probably put something out there online, whether it was Facebook or Instagram or, you know, some kind of message board or chat, whatever else. Oh, hey, there's this guy. His name is blah, blah, blah. He looks like blah, blah, blah. He might try to come and record what you're doing and put it on his blah, blah, blah page, you know? So that's just one example. But yeah, it's not worth taking the risk. It is very possible that even that up to this day, I could be more transparent about who I am in terms of my name and what I look like and just things I do in my life. You know, how people on their Instagram story, for example, just post random things that they're doing. It is possible that I could live that way and still be able to get away with a lot of this kind of stuff. But to me, it's just not worth the risk. So I just need to, I just need to try to keep it under wraps as much as possible. And that's just the way it's always going to be. Now, with that being said, as time goes on, it is harder to keep your identity concealed. 'Cause, for example, when I exposed something a number of years ago, I got some people so pissed off that they actually, I don't have proof of this, but I think it has to be the case that they hired a private investigator and they found out who I was and they doxed me. Luckily, it's not something that a ton of people caught on to, so I'm still fairly anonymous. But yeah, you just have to be really careful. So, and I was there a second part to your question too that I have didn't answer?
I think the second part was about, how do you go about it to erase your identity?
Okay, yeah.
And
I pretty much covered that, right?
yes. And maybe you should not go into the details of all that you do to cover up who you are. How do you feel about that, being undercover? Because my first reaction when I heard your answer was, oh, this sounds exciting. This is like being a spy, but for a good cause. But do you feel sometimes stressed by having to do that?
Yeah, to me it's almost like a form of repression, and I try to be as free as possible of a person and not really be suppressed in any ways that unless it's something that I absolutely have to suppress, which this would be an example of that. But it's just the way you got to play the game. There's most a lot of what I've done up to this day, and will continue to do, you just can't do by being honest. Now, when I do interact with some animal exploiters, I do try to integrate as much honesty as possible, but there's a fine line to that. And hold on one sec, I just kind of lost my train of thought, but it'll come back in a sec. Can you just say your question one more time, and then I can get my train of thought back?
Yes. So I was thinking how, it was exciting, and then I was also wondering if it could be, stressful at times.
So the exciting part of it for sure is when I get to accomplish my goals, because some of this stuff is really difficult. To figure out, to form a game plan, to execute, and then obviously the emotional toll and so forth. But yeah, when I was a lot younger, I don't really do this anymore, but when I was a lot younger, I used to be kind of a big prankster. I would trick a lot of people. I mean, humans generally are pretty gullible beings. And I would trick people all the time, be like, oh, gotcha. And, yeah, at some point in time, I stopped doing that, and now I use those skills I have to act and to trick others for a good cause, for animal rights. And back in the day, I could just make up a prank spontaneously and just go through with it and accomplish what I was after. But with this kind of thing, there's a whole lot of work that has to go into it. It's a lot less being spontaneous, and it's a lot more building things up, building up, stories and more tangible things, and developing alternative personalities and so forth. And yeah, it's a lot. I of course I'm not going to get into the details of that, but it's almost a whole another job in itself. But it is exciting to be able to pull things off in the way that I do and be able to show certain angles of what humans are doing to animals that nobody else is really covering or really has covered in the past. So it is nice to be able to, provide unique forms of activism to the world.
To do that, in order to build this story about yourself that is convincing, and in order to create relationships with the people you want to cover, who are usually animal abusers, you need to look at them, through more than this two-dimensional view we often see represented online of animal abusers, like farmers are those horrible monsters who this and that. I understand the feeling behind it, but I also see that those people are more than what they do. And that this, psychologically, humanly, it's more complex than I guess the person who put it best would be Dr. Crystal Heath. Maybe you know her. And she mentioned how animal abusers are basically brainwashed by a cult, like cult members, and we need to see them like this. So how do you perceive animal abusers, those farmers that you meet? Do you feel that way, that they are those monsters, or do you tend more towards, they're more like brainwashed cult members?
For me, it's more of an individual to individual basis. I don't think you can paint animal abusers and animal killers, etc., with a broad brush. So, I mean, for example, I do think that I do concur with Crystal Heath when it comes for some. I do think some are, just really brainwashed, and they've had things normalized to them since they were probably infants, and they can't see these things for what they truly are. But I think other people just decide to embrace becoming animal abusers on their own. I mean, for example, the last thing that one of the not the very last thing, but one of the last things that I documented was turkeys being killed on a small farm back in November, just shortly before Thanksgiving. And I asked the farmer, "Did you grow up on a farm?" And a lot of the time, actually probably most of the time, people say yes, but sometimes that's not the case. And yeah, this guy just decided to embrace it on his own. I don't know what his upbringing was like, but I know he didn't grow up on a farm. So he decided to, build a farm on his own and have chickens and pigs and cows and turkeys and so forth. And yeah, just learn all this from zero. And I was able to, I was able to connect with him, not from an organic perspective of who I truly am, but I acted like, factory farming is the big is the that's the real monster, and this kind of thing is this is the right way to do things. And I talked about how what he was doing was pretty much truly pasture raised, and what's normally labeled pasture raised, like when you buy something at a grocery store, is a total lie. And which there was a little bit of truth to that. I mean, his turkeys were for most of their short life, actually living on pasture. Whereas when you buy something at the grocery store and it says pasture raised, that's actually not even how it truly is. But yeah, I mean, if I were to all of a sudden be like, this is not cool, this you don't need to be doing this to animals and so forth, things could have gone really differently, and he could have got really violent with me potentially. But yeah, I think for humans, when it comes to everything, whether it's how we treat animals, how we treat other humans, how we treat the planet, etc., there's just like a wide variety of humans, and different causes to their behavior. So yeah, I think there's actually a growing trend now to just growing your own food. And for some people, they consider breeding animals and fattening them up and then killing them akin to, growing plants from putting seeds in the ground. So, yeah, I don't know. I've definitely interacted with a wide variety of people, and some are far worse than others. But the one thing that I think almost all of us share in common is we know right from wrong. And so I think a lot of people who do these types of things to animals, somewhere deep down, I think a lot of them do know that what they're doing is wrong and unnecessary, but they just don't care enough to change, especially since wider society approves of what they're doing. And not only just approves, but I think animal farmers are some of the most respected people in society. So, whereas vegans and animal rights activists were on the opposite end of that. So, yeah, hopefully that was a decent answer to that question.
Yes, and I get the same impression. So, what? How do you deal when with the situation where things go wrong, where your cover is blown up, where you get those violent reactions? How do you deal with that?
Well, there haven't been that many times when my cover has been blown. And in fact, usually it's been something that I've done on purpose. For example, I documented a religious animal sacrifice in New York City for a number of years called Kaporos. And the first 2 years I did that, I was completely undercover, and I'm totally willing to say on your podcast what my whole cover story was, because this was a one-time thing. It's not something I'm ever going to use again, so I don't mind sharing it. But yeah, I was gaining access to there's all kinds of locations all throughout the city where people openly torture chickens. They'll pick up the Cornish cross chickens. They're the overly grown white ones that people tend to eat for their flesh that are usually killed when they're only 42 days old. I would estimate for a Kaporos, most of the chickens that they're using for the Cornish cross are generally probably anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks old. And they'll in the vast majority of cases, they well, first off, these chickens are kept in crates for days and days at a time. Without any food or water, they're not protected from the weather. Whether it's sometimes, because this usually happens in September or October. So sometimes when Kaporos occurs, it's extremely hot outside. Other times it's extremely cold outside, and also the rain too. But anyway, these chickens just live in such degrading conditions. Actually, even worse than where they're coming from, the industrial farms than where they're coming from. Now they're packed even tighter and they have no protection. Whereas when they're living in those giant warehouses, they at least have some protection from the weather. But yeah, all of a sudden, when they do finally get to exit the crates, they're pulled up by their wings and they're swung around a minimum of 2 times, which is the harshest way you can possibly hold a chicken. And then after that, they get killed at a certain point, sometimes right afterwards, and sometimes there's a delay. And also, I should say, when they're living in those tightly packed crates with other chickens, they're usually living amongst not only dead but also decaying chickens. So it's a complete horror show. But anyway, when I decided to go there and document this, I didn't want to just take photos and videos of what was happening. I wanted to actually have conversations with people that were involved with this. And I wanted to go all over the city because they have so many locations where they do this. And so I was telling people that I was writing a book about freedom of religion. And I said that this is the basically my case study. This is what I'm gonna use to illustrate. This is what I use for the theme of my book, the Kaporos ritual. And I never told anyone that I was for what they were doing, but I also never told anyone that I was against what they were doing. I said I'm neutral about it. I also told them that I'm Jewish because this is a Jewish thing. Most Jewish denominations don't practice this. It's just the Orthodox and the ultra Orthodox. Actually, not even Orthodox. It's just the ultra Orthodox, I believe, who do this. And I identified as Reformed Jew, which, by the way, is partially true. I mean, that is how I grew up. So back to what I was saying in the beginning of the podcast, where I try to be with as honest with people as possible. So that is like a form of honesty that I was sharing. But yeah, anyway, when I told people when I told people my cover story, they were perfectly willing to let me, not all of them, but most of them were perfectly willing to let me document what they were doing. And if they weren't comfortable with it, I would say, oh yeah, no problem. And I would just not, I would just not, point my camera at them. And I would just leave them alone. I would stop talking to them unless they wanted to keep talking to me. And yeah, I gained a lot of access. I also told them that I was not just going to be documenting what they were doing, but I was also going to be documenting the protesters, because there was a very strong, very big opposition to Kaporos at the time. That is not true nowadays, but at the time there was a lot of vocal opposition. And they would tell me things about the Kaporos, or about, yeah, about the Kaporos protesters that were completely untrue. They would make up blanket statements such as every female who protests this has had an abortion, and they would say all kinds of crazy stuff. So anyway, I kept that up for 2 years. It was amazing as far as the access that I gained. And then, once I had all that documentation, I still wanted to go to the, I still wanted to return to New York City on an annual basis and record what was happening. But because I had ample documentation already, I no longer felt it was necessary, to remain undercover, especially since this is just this is, even though it's a big thing, it's a small world, it's a small bubble that I was accessing. This is Kaporos, whereas animal farming is like a vast thing. So the animal farming, I got to keep that cover going for pretty much my whole life. This, it doesn't didn't matter as much. Plus, this can also be documented whether you have permission to or not, because a lot of this takes place on public streets and sidewalks. But yeah, so once I, so year three when I went, I was openly against what they were doing, and I was, criticizing them openly. I was asking people to hold the chickens in a better way. And yeah, that's almost like a welfarist perspective, but, or it is a welfarist perspective, but you're not going to change most 99.9% of these people. You're not going to change their mind. So at least if you can get someone to hold a chicken, in a way that doesn't cause harm. I mean, you still are harming the chicken with what you're doing, but you're going to cause them significantly less harm if you hold them from, like, with their wings pinned to their body the way they're supposed to be, and you put your hands underneath. That's going to cause drastically less suffering than, holding them by up by their wings and swinging them around. So, yeah, I would do that. Of course, I would try to get people to, stop doing this and give me their chicken so I could help get that chicken to a sanctuary, which I did have a little bit of luck with a couple of chickens, but it wasn't someone necessarily just trying to be nice. It was one woman. I just walked away with her chicken because she actually let me show her how to hold the chicken. And I was like, well, I'm going to show her how to hold the chicken, and then I'm going to walk away with the chicken. And worst case scenario, I just have to give the chicken back. Best case scenario, this chicken gets to go to a sanctuary. So, yeah, I walked away with the chicken, and she didn't try to chase me or, or get anyone else to go after me. So that was a good story. And then there was another woman who, she was actively doing the ritual, swinging a chicken around. And she saw me taking photos of her, or video for that matter. And she asked me not to do that. And I said to her, the only way I'm gonna stop recording you doing this is if you put that chicken down, give them to me so I can take them, get them to a sanctuary. Now, being honest, I don't know if that's actually how I worded it, but basically I told her that if I will stop recording if you give me the chicken. And she did. So that chicken got to go to a sanctuary. I have no idea what happened to them. I'm not able to I wasn't able to find out those details, but anyway, yeah, that was an example of going from undercover to not undercover, having my cover blown. And there were several people that noticed that, like, wait, what the hell? That's not who I thought that was. There was one guy, I can't remember what his name was or exactly what he was all about, but I remember we had some long conversations about Kaporos. And yeah, of course, he had totally bought into my cover story. I saw him those first 2 years, so we had long conversations those first 2 years, and he was around me when I was documenting stuff. And then the next year, he sees me being openly opposed to this, and he's like, "What's going on?" And I told him, like, after seeing this numerous times, I actually feel now that it's completely wrong and this is just pure evil. You don't need to be doing this. You can't transfer your sins to a chicken, because that's what the people say. They say when you're swinging the chicken and you're reciting this prayer that you're reading on your cell phone, that your sins are going into this chicken. And you've been absolved of all sins, and now you get to fresh start. And now you can commit sins for the next year, and then you can do this again with the chickens again. So anyway, I was just telling him how I thought this was ridiculous, and he was telling me that I'm mansplaining, but in a Jewish sense, like I'm Jewish-splaining or something. It was so ridiculous. But the people there, I have to this day, I haven't been physically injured by any of them, but they can be very dangerous. I have been in some very hostile, very scary situations with some of these people. They are used to getting away with whatever they want, partially because the cops let them get away with whatever they want typically. But yeah, besides that, there haven't been many other situations I can really think of where my cover has been blown. I've always been able to maintain that very well. With that being said, I would like to say that a lot of people who have given me access to cover their form of animal abuse have asked me if I'm a pete if I'm a if I'm with PETA, and I say I'm not. PETA has never hired me to do anything, so it is true, but it's just really funny to me because I can't remember when PETA started. I think it was the 70s or the 80s. But obviously they've been around for a long time, and since their inception, tons of other organizations have popped up, and obviously there's like a lot of people just doing their own individual thing like me. So it's just funny that, oh, because you say no, you're not affiliated with PETA, that okay, you're safe. You're safe for me to let into this space. So yeah, it's amazing that people still haven't like caught on to like how broad the animal protection movement, if you want to call it that, really is. So, sorry, that was like a really long answer to your question.
But it was all very interesting, so thank you. Before we pressed the recording and started the recording of the episode, we were talking about independent media and the importance of being independent in covering issues. And you are, an independent journalist. I know you describe yourself as a photograph, but I do see you as a journalist and a quality journalist. So why is it important to be independent? And what are the struggles of being independent in this line of work?
I'd say it's important to be independent because I don't think for the vast majority of the kind of work that I've done so far, I don't think I really need other people, telling me about telling me how I should go about things. I've been pretty successful in a sense thus far with, completing my missions and trying to d being able to do what I'm striving to do. I don't think anyone, needs to have any control over me, unless I am doing something for another organization. If they're hiring me to do something for them, then yeah, I mean, if they need me to, do something specific or go about something in a different way, then yeah, there's room for, discussing that. But I like to one of the things that helps keep me going and continuing to do this work is getting to basically be my own boss and not coming into conflict and friction and tension with other people trying to interfere with what I'm doing. And yeah, I see a lot with animal rights and other causes that people get heavily opinionated and they think they know what's the best way, they think they know what's right. And I don't claim to know what's the best way or know what's right or what's most effective or impactful or persuasive. I honestly have no idea. And I think more of us should admit that we don't have any idea because this is a very experimental kind of thing that we're doing. I think a lot of the parallels that people bring up, well, oh, well, this worked during the civil rights movement, so you got to do it this way. I don't think a lot of that applies to animal rights. I mean, trying to gain progress for humans is a vastly different undertaking than trying to gain progress for animals. I mean, humans are animals, of course, but or at least most of us, most of wider society looks at animals through a completely different lens. And although we can look at history and what's worked for certain causes and try to apply that to our own struggles that we're dealing with to accomplish progress for animals, we can try these things, but it doesn't mean that it's gonna work. And we have to really think out of the box and get really experimental and stop acting like we know what's best. All of us are in a constant state of learning, or if we're not, we're stagnant and we need to get back to the process of trying to learn. So, I think there's a lot of trial and error. I've made plenty of mistakes. I have had people try to tell me things in the past that I, discarded and didn't take seriously, that in hindsight I should have taken more seriously, especially as it relates to burnout and not being so tireless and pushing myself so hard and not getting sidetracked from other important things in my life, such as being present in my relationship and so forth. But I when I do some when I'm wrong about something, I admit it and I try to be better in the future. As far as the struggles for being independent, I would say one is definitely the money. If my work was under a broader organization, I'm assuming I would be getting paid for that. And that would help me to stay afloat in general life aside from activism, and it would also help me to continue my activism work. So with being independent, there's not much money in it. I do have a Patreon, which did get near or even cross $800 a month back in 2019, I believe. And then it kind of dwindled from there. And right now it's just a little over $200, which I am grateful for. I don't want people to get the wrong impression and think I'm a brat and be like, oh, I'm only getting this much. Like, I'm grateful for any donation I get. Obviously, people don't have to donate to me, and there's all kinds of great things out there to donate. So I'm very appreciative to everyone who donates. But $200 can't, carry you very far. And And when I give things to activists and when I do things for some organizations, I don't actually even charge anything. It's just like if you want to give me something, you can. Here's the link to my donation page. But I don't ask for anything specific numbers wise or tell anyone you have to give me anything. And also, sometimes I go like a really long time without even helping any activists or organizations out because I don't get any kind of requests for a long time. And I think a lot of people, even to this day, still don't know about me and what I do. With my day job, my current day job, it just doesn't pay very much money. Stress management is extremely important to me, keeping as low a stress as life as I practically can. So with that being said, when I had to do my last job search, I was looking for a job that wouldn't cause me immense stress and something that would align with my values and my interests. And I did find such a job. But for one, it's not full-time work, which I'm not necessarily complaining about. And two, it just doesn't pay very well. But I'm still grateful that I have a job like that because I've never had that experience with a job before. Now I'm in a stage of trying to start something new, which I can't get into the personal details of that, but something new that could potentially earn me a decent amount of money, and that is not going to be a passion of mine, but is related to my interests, and that will definitely help me have more income than I can distribute to my, animal rights pursuits. So I'm, very much looking forward to that. When that day comes, when I have more financial freedom to get back to doing, more activism more regularly. Oh, there's one more thing I wanted to say about that. What was that? Oh, yes. So I am also working on developing the portfolio on my website, and it's probably technically good enough right now, but there's still so much more I can add and show like the broader depth of my work. So once it gets to a point where I'm more pleased, I am going to start applying to more organizations to be undercover investigators for them because I haven't done that in a while. Like really put my name out there and apply to different places. So hopefully after I do that, I will have more organizations contacting me and wanting to, hiring me for certain things and being able to just trust my judgment and know that they don't really have to, give me many directions. Just tell me what you want and I'll go try to do it for you.
And I will add a link in the episode's notes of your Patreon. And please also visit the website. The website is wonderful. I think it's unparalleledsuffering.org.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It's, and the pictures, I haven't said that yet, but the pictures you take are just like professional quality level, just wonderful. I'm not a photographer, not even amateur photographer, but they're truly beautiful to look at, even though the subject of the photography is a hard, soul-crushing one.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I feel the same, not trying to be self-boasting or anything, but I also get that feedback from a lot of people, like, oh, this is such a beautiful picture, but I don't mean it that way. I mean it's a really good picture, but it's absolutely horrific what the picture, and that's exactly what I'm trying to go for. I want the emotion. I want to hit people with as much emotion as possible from the photographs and thought. I want my photographs to be thought-provoking, and I also want people to be able to grasp like the quality, because I do try to do as high quality as possible. It's not just like, oh, this is happening, let me take a picture of it. I try to frame everything in a way and capture everything in a way as high quality as I can, possibly think of. So there's, when I'm at shoots, there's like tons of stuff going through my head for how I can best capture this. And yeah, also right now, most of my website's just photographs, but I have tons and tons of video of stuff too. So just trying to do one thing at a time. So I'm just gonna get all the photos on the website first, and then I'll start posting more videos on there. And I want to get a little bit more experimental too with the kinds of things that I do. And I would like to start doing street interviews, not in the kind of like earthling it in Joey Carbstrong fashion, which that's, I don't mean that as an insult to them. I think they do pretty good work. But mine, you won't obviously see me in the videos. And I'm going to try to have conversations with people and ask them kinds of things that you don't hear in these other kinds of street interview videos. Because those videos kind of get a little bit redundant. I think they're good for people who aren't vegan and they're hearing these things for the first time. But as a vegan who's already had these conversations with people and heard other people have them a million times, I'm trying to come up with angles that ha are that pretty much haven't been discussed yet. So that'll be hopefully a new thing that I start doing kind of soon.
Or even people, who, like you mentioned, Earthling Ed, he's never talking to religious leaders, like the ones, the Jewish ultra-Orthodox ones in New York. So I want to hear them, answer your questions. So that would be a new angle for starters.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. I actually did send Earthling Ed a direct message many years ago, and I told him he should come out to Kaporos, 'cause not just to do like what you were just talking about, but also to get his own little documentation and just like let people know that this is happening, 'cause he has. I have a very small platform. He has a massive one. I also sent a direct message to James Aspie many years ago too, when he was more involved with animal rights activism, and I told him he should come out to Kaporos. Not saying, oh, you better come out because you have a big following and this is your moral responsibility, but he had a lot of flexibility for where he went and what he did with his time. So I wanted to make both of these gentlemen aware of something good that they could do with their time. But and also I think that would also be really important to have conversations with people like that, the ultra-Orthodox and Haredi population in New York City and elsewhere possibly, because they are a very large growing segment of the population. They breed like crazy. They pretty much try to have as many kids as possible. And they've overtaken many parts of New York City. Some streets that used to have zero of them are now they're living in every single house or just about every house. And yeah, they're one of the most hardcore brainwashing segments of society that we have. Their brainwashing is absolutely brutal, and I think, and it's very hard to ha not even just the adults, but even the children, even by the time they're only like 7 or 8 years old, are already severely brainwashed. So it's really hard to penetrate them with facts about animals and diet and so forth. But to me, I think it's worth having the conversation, if you can, and putting it out there for people to see. Plus, I think it can sharpen our perspectives, because I don't think people understand the complexity of like changing the world for animals. I mean, we're up against so much, and if you're paying attention, you kind of see that what we're up against is just the complexity of it is basically limitless. Because as you learn more, you'll continue to have a broader perspective, and you see that it's these changes that we're after are just beyond difficult. Difficult is a minuscule understatement for the reality that we're actually presented with here. So.
And let me add an argument for, talking to religious leaders. Most people on this planet will not listen to you. They will listen to their rabbi. They will listen to their imam. They will listen to their priest. Those religious leaders are the ones who give their moral stamp of approval on certain practices and beliefs. And veganism is not part of the stamp approved ideologies out there. So better get them convinced so they can give their approval and spread the word on their own than address some random person on the street or some college kids who have no power and no influence on anyone.
Yeah, I think that's an absolutely brilliant point, because it's so hard to change anyone. Humans are, generally speaking, very stuck in their ways and very concrete with their thinking. But if you are able to influence someone to change for the better, of course that's a great thing. But in most cases, that's not going to lead to much broader change. That might literally just be that one person. Whereas a religious leader, like you pointed out, that could have a huge ripple effect. Because as you said, people listen to those people and change their ways according to the way their leaders change their ways in many cases. And that actually makes me think back about this whole Kaporos that I was talking about a little bit ago. I've never deliberately tried to, I've never deliberately tried to engage with any of these leaders, about Kaporos and why it makes no sense and it's cruel, and also the fact that there's an alternative to it. If you are going to do the Kaporos, custom, you don't have to swing a live animal around and kill them. There's an alternative form where you can actually swing money or coins around and donate that to the poor. And it's seen as just as valid for the custom. So when I'm talking to people at Kaporos, I don't know who I'm talking to. I may have talked to some religious leaders, but I typically don't ask them about their background. But yeah, in 2018, I believe it was, or 2009, might have been 2019, I released a documentary, short documentary called "Robin Rescued from the Dead," and it's a story about this chicken who, when I was documenting Kaporos, I was near the trash bags, because the Kaporos people tell you that the chickens get donated to the poor, and in most cases this isn't true. They actually just get thrown in garbage bags and get hauled to landfills. So I was at the location where they have the most Kaporos use and killing, and I was there where it was just like the aftermath. So there's bodies on the ground, then there's most of the bodies are concealed in these garbage bags. There's just like a huge amount of garbage bags full of the chickens. And I was just standing by the garbage bags waiting for a trash truck to waiting for the sanitation department to pull up and load them in to the truck to take them to the landfill. And I noticed movement in one of the bags right beside me. There's clearly a chicken in there that wasn't dead. So I notified a nearby activist who was standing, just feet away from me, and I was recording. So she opened the bag and she pulls out this pathetic looking chicken, with a cut to their throat, but they had missed the main artery, and the chicken was still alive. Now I didn't at the time, I didn't have any hope for the chicken. I thought they were going to die within minutes. I mean, they were that bare minimum. They were in that sealed garbage bag full of dead bodies for a half hour, bare minimum. Anyway, long story short, the chicken did end up going, with a sanctuary owner, getting some emergency care, some emergency surgeries, and they did survive. They're even still alive to this day. But for one, that was 2 minutes before the trash truck arrived, and they would have their main their they would have probably ended up dying by getting crushed in the trash truck. So that's one huge thing. And so I don't know how this happened, but a rabbi at one of these, they call it a Chabad. That's what they call the synagogue setting for the ultra Orthodox. He saw my documentary, and he reached out, I believe, to the sanctuary owner, Vanessa Dawson, who has a sanctuary called Penelope's Place. She's who took in this chicken named Robin. She reached out, and the rabbi said, "I'm going to tell my whole congregation to not use chickens anymore for Kapporos." So that is, in the grand scheme of things, that's just a even in the grand scheme of things, just for Kapporos, set aside everything else, that is just a little drop in the bucket. But it's still, if that really did happen, if he really, I know he said those things, I know that email really happened, but if he really did follow through, because sometimes people say things and then they end up not having the courage to actually do these things, and there was no follow-up with the guy, as far as I know. But as long as he had the courage to actually tell his congregation to not use chickens anymore, and he maybe explained why, then that's a really good impact that would have happened for my little documentary. And not just my documentary, but all the things that led up to the documentary being made. So
What a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. Truly, I mean, I guess from all the stories out there, the ones of animals and the footage of them escaping, going against the odds, just jumping out of the truck or finding their way out of the ranch, those are the most touching to me, because what are the chances of getting out of this machine of death, and still here you are, safe and finding your way to humans who don't want to kill you, who don't want to torture you or eat you, and who actually want to care for you. It's I'm always in awe of those stories. I think they're the best out there.
I totally agree. And not just that, but also another thing that's really powerful is what happens afterwards, the transformation, the healing, because they come to these sanctuaries with so much damage, physical damage, psychological damage, maybe personality issues because they have trust issues and they still see humans as the enemy. And then they see after a certain time that they're safe. They get enough care to heal physically, and many of them have they display behavior that's indicative of PTSD trauma, and then you see them change. And for me, I don't have much of that. I don't really have that experience because I don't have a sanctuary, but I've heard it from other sanctuary owners, whether it's hearing these stories in person or seeing their social media posts or listening to podcasts like yours. And it's just absolutely amazing to see the radical change that that animals can go through with our help. And in turn, that can help heal us as well, in varying degrees. And like that chicken that I just mentioned, Robin, he clearly suffered. He clearly had major PTSD, and he had some, behavior issues when he first came to the sanctuary, like incessant pecking, for example, which is no fun for the person taking care of them. But after a certain number of days, or maybe it was like a week or 2 weeks tops, I don't even think it took 2 weeks, or maybe not even a whole week. The chicken, Robin, clearly knew that he was in a good place and he was safe and loved, and nothing like that was ever going to happen to him again. So yeah, very, very moving stuff. And that's something that I care about a lot, incorporating into my work too. Showing sanctuary as a contrast, sanctuary, liberation, rescue, love as a contrast to the animal exploitation and abuse and killing, because it's good to show how animals can be in different environments and how we can have different relationships with them. And it doesn't have to be the way it's always been. We are flooded with choices on a daily basis. I can be a radically different person tomorrow if I wanted to, and so can everyone else. We have the freedom to do that. So, yeah, I think. anyway, sorry, I forget where that was going, but I think I said enough in regards to that.
Well, it's beautifully said, and I'm happy because in preparation for this interview, I thought, what topics need to be covered, and I found this section in your website where you list your focuses. So basically, what your line of work is about, and we covered lots of items on that list. So the first one would be the humane myth, and then the second one, state and country fairs, rodeos and other abusive entertainment events is another one, zoos and aquariums. Now, aquariums is a tricky one, and I did an episode on with sanctuary owner, the sanctuary owner behind Friends of Phillips. And we discussed how it is much harder to develop a bond with aquatic life or even feel compassion for their suffering. And I get that all the time, and all vegans get it too. You don't even eat fish. Fish should be the exception, like, because they don't have feelings. It's just a fish, and it's already hard with like land animals. So the level of difficulty to just create that bond with or that connection with marine life is just, tremendously harder. So how do you try to, create that through your work?
Well, I'm all about promoting the potential to have bonds with animals like, pigs and chickens and cows and so forth, land animals who we can relate to more. I've never, at least as far as I remember, I've never done anything to promote having bonds with aquatic animals, even though I know that it is possible in some circumstances, certainly not all circumstances. But for me, it's more about just treating them fairly and compassionately and leaving them alone. And I think our circle of justice and fairness should include other animals, including aquatic animals, whether there's the potential for bond or not. So yeah, I've documented a lot of fish being sold in stores. I've documented aquariums. I've documented some fishing, nothing that comes close to commercial fishing, but I've documented a lot of these youth fishing derbies where young children and sometimes young teenagers are brought there and taught to taught if they don't already know, which in many cases they don't already know how to pull these creatures out of the water and let them suffocate and so forth. And sometimes you can like it is harder to capture the suffering of aquatic animals than it is for animals like chickens and pigs, but it can be done. I've definitely done it many, many times over. But and I think I just think it's I think it's not difficult to point out like the wrongdoing of this, like, because we know that these things are unnecessary. We don't need to take animals out of their wild habitats and ship them in a truck and put them in a tiny little fish tank and use them as a decoration in our house or something that's fun to look at every now and then. We don't need to have hatcheries where we breed fish and then we release them into a lake for people to trick with a worm or something on the end of the hook and then pull out of their of where they're able to actually live. So for me, it's just about justice and fairness and preventing suffering and embracing change for the better. It's not about promoting like a bond. So I know with the one person you mentioned where you're talking about aquariums, I know they have I'm not very familiar with the work that they do, but I do know that they have a aquatic sanctuary where they have rescued animals such as betta fishes and so forth. And I'm sure they do have as much of a bond as you possibly can have with a creature like that. So I think it's important for them to carry out that kind of work and show that perspective, but that's not what I do personally. I just try to point out the clear, obvious, blatant wrongdoing that humans are engaging in, and just basically requesting an end to this, you know?
Yes, let me go through the rest of the list. Slaughterhouses and rendering plants. Now, I never set foot in a slaughterhouse. I did visit a dairy farm, dairy factory farm once, but never a slaughterhouse. What is it like?
I don't have a general opinion about what it's like in a slaughterhouse. I've had a lot of different experiences. I've also just done some documenting outside of slaughterhouses where I've never seen what the inside looks like. I've never been in a major slaughterhouse, you know, like a Tyson slaughterhouse or anything like that. I've been in much smaller ones. And I've even been to things where animals are not even killed, and some of those things are even worse than some of the slaughterhouses I've been to, like a pig wrestling event that I went to once in Wisconsin. That was the worst energy I've ever experienced, the darkest energy I've ever experienced, like more so than any slaughterhouse I've been in. But yeah, I mean, they're obviously really depressing places, and the animals are always kept in horrendous conditions. And just like when I've seen animals killed on farms, the animals are always killed in front of each other. So they can always see what's coming. They can smell it, they can hear it too. There was only one slaughterhouse I've ever been to where I saw how it was operated, and the owner did make a deliberate effort to shield the animals from the other animals being killed before them. With that being said, I haven't returned to that place, although I would like to in 2025 as soon as possible. So I don't know if that's still how it is. I know the place was under construction at the time, so I don't. It was under construction, but they were still like killing animals, so I don't know if anything's changed there. But I certainly wouldn't call it humane by any means, but I did at least appreciate the effort of that guy to not expose the animals to how the animals were being killed before them. Because most it's I mean that should be a no-brainer. That should Not that I approve of slaughterhouses even existing, but if they are going to exist, that's how they should all operate. But that's humans, whether it's a small farm or a small slaughterhouse or a big slaughterhouse, it's really just always about convenience and efficiency for the humans. And it does detract from the convenience factor to not just let all the animals be killed in front of each other. But yeah, I mean, generally you see and you hear a lot of panic and terror in the animals. Sometimes you see them trying to like face the other way to not see what's going on. You see a lot of like huddling together, screaming, definitely a lot of fighting to get free, trying to escape the cage or the enclosure, whatever they're in. Generally fight to their last breath. Always to from what I've seen in most cases, it's always just ultimate disregard. It's never about trying to minimize the pain for the animals and trying to make things as quick as possible. There is one slaughterhouse in Stockton, California that anyone could see. It's not like open to the public per se, where you can like walk in, but they don't shield themselves from public view. They shackle the, I don't know if you're already familiar with this place, but it's called, actually, sorry, I forget what it's called. It might be just called Stockton Poultry Market. I can't remember. But anyway, they shackle the animals, right? They have the door wide open, and they shackle the chickens right next to the sidewalk. It's on a public street, so you can't see the actual killing because the room that the chickens start in that first room, and then they're led into another room, and that's where the killing's going on, and they do have that blocked off. But you can see enough from the sidewalk to see what these chickens are going through, and there were a couple times I went there with my previous partner, and we asked if we could just have a chicken, and the specific worker both times just handed us a chicken. And I know of other people. I've heard of someone else who lives out there in California. I don't live in California. I've heard of someone who lives out there in California and goes there from the time to time, and they get a chicken as well. So, I don't necessarily say it's an act of compassion for the worker to do that. Maybe it is. I don't know what's going through the person's mind, but it's obviously nice that they did that. They don't have to do that. There was no pressure. We didn't, I didn't, it wasn't like, oh, give us a chicken or else I'm gonna blah, blah, blah. I'm gonna put your face all over the internet. Like, we didn't do anything like that. We just simply said, can we have a chicken? And he did it. And most slaughterhouses, I don't think you would have any such luck. So, that was a good experience I've had at a sanctuary. Not once again, not trying to humane wash the place. And then as far as like transparency, generally the ones where they're the most transparent with letting you see everything, including the killing, are the halal slaughterhouses. I've had several halal slaughterhouses. I did have to use a cover story. I didn't say I was vegan. But with that being said, one of the halal slaughterhouses I went to, a vegan left the person a bad review on Google reviews, and this vegan never actually visited the sanctuary. There's a misconception out there that halal slaughter is like worse than non-halal slaughter, but I think it's like all equally as bad, pretty much. And anyway, the slaughterhouse owner replied back to this guy's comment and said, like, you can come visit the slaughterhouse, I'll let you see everything. And he was totally honest. I even talked to the guy afterwards, and I know sometimes there's like a popular thing where farmers pretend that you can come out to their farm, and they're trying to sound like they're okay. They know that what they're doing is good, and they're okay with you seeing it. But it's really like a gotcha kind of thing. It's not for real. But this guy actually was for real. But yeah, whoever this vegan person was, they never actually took the person up on their offer. And one experience I want to talk about at a slaughterhouse, I pulled up to a slaughterhouse in Minnesota where they kill, it's 100% just chickens who have come from egg farms. And I think all or most of these chickens have lived their whole life in cages. So chickens of that sort typically all come with broken bones. They're just like really fragile. They're, mangled and everything. And when you pull up to the slaughterhouse, it's on a public street. It's in a very small town. It's kind of similar in the way that I was just talking about the one in Stockton, where you can see them shackling from the sidewalk. This has that feature too, where you can see the chickens being shackled from the sidewalk. But these guys are way rougher with the chickens. They would grab more chickens at a time, way more violently, and shackle them more violently. And when they noticed me with my camera, they actually close the door, whereas the one in Stockton doesn't do that. So anyway, I put my drone in the air, and they had a big rendering truck in the parking lot, and it was really neatly organized by it's a long trailer, and it's very organized by body parts. So it's like a big mountain of this one body part, then the next body part, then the next. And much to my surprise, as far as I know, I'm the first and only person still to this day to ever document this. There were actually live chickens in the rendering truck on top of the vast mountains of body parts, and some were dead. There were some whole chickens with feathers and everything that were dead, but there were some that were still moving. And unfortunately, I made the mistake of thinking I was recording and I wasn't recording. But then I realized I wasn't actually recording, and I started recording. So I still did get a little bit of footage of some of these live chickens moving around in there. And then I got a knock on the window from a woman who was, I think she was like the wife of the person who owned the slaughterhouse, and she was like, just freaking out at me. But yeah, so basically there's a lot of dark things happening at slaughterhouses that have still to this day never been documented, that we have absolutely no idea about. And that's why I'm a very strong proponent of doing investigations on slaughterhouses that way too, like with drones. And of course, that's a lot of the document that I'm doing. I'm not undercover. This is an example. I'm not like going in and up, I want to write a nice story about you for the paper. Do you mind if I get some drone shots? I'm just pulling up and I'm just putting a drone in there. I don't give a shit what they think about me or how much they get pissed off. And also, I found out afterwards, because I didn't even look this place up before I went there. I just saw, oh, there's this place here. I'm going to go see what they're up to, see what they're up to the best of my ability. And then I looked them up after that day, and I found out that Humane Society of the United States had an actual investigator working in there several years before I went. And it was one of the most disgusting undercover investigation videos I've ever seen. They had like a higher than average rate of boiling birds alive. And it was a great investigation that the HSUS did, but it hasn't led to any change at all. And then PETA put something out about them like a year or two after I went there. And this was in relation to thousands of birds freezing in the trucks in the middle of the winter. So this place is just getting away with so much stuff. And no matter what comes out about them, they don't change their ways. They don't get, penalized or anything. And yeah, it's just really sad. But yeah, just I've had a lot of very different experiences at different kinds of slaughterhouses. The ones that I've been invited in, people have generally been very friendly to me. And the ones when I show up uninvited and try to record with my drone or stand on a sidewalk, there's a lot of hostility. I had one slaughterhouse owner try to follow me home once. He was driving behind me for a while, and then I wasn't gonna let him follow me all the way, so I got out of my car at a stop sign and I just went up to him and I was like recording with my cell phone, and then all these other cars are behind him and they're getting all aggravated and honking and stuff, and he finally turns around. So vast variety of experiences, but nothing to this day that's been, way too bad, besides just, visuals that I've had to take in.
That's truly fascinating. And going back to that point about being independent, you said, you were the first getting that footage. And that's the thing, when you don't control people, when you give them a level of independence, they do first. They come up with original ideas, and they enact, original methods of, getting that footage or things like that. So that's another argument for being independent. And to complete that list, just as a reference, you know, for people to visit the website, religious animal sacrifice, we covered that in depth, fishing derbies, animal rights, and farmed animal sanctuaries, of course. And yes, so I highly recommend people to go and visit your website. It's truly wonderful. You get real good sense of your level of professionalism and what it looks like, you know, to do honest, inquisitive, and independent reporting work. So yes,
Thank you
congratulations.
very
I
much.
want to say, you know, wonderful work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And we didn't talk about it at all, but the fairs that I've been to document, I've documented tons and tons of fairs, county and state fairs, and those are things that, you know, you don't have to get permission to go in and document. They're open to the public. You only have to be undercover in the sense that you act at least neutral or like you're okay with what's going on, because you know if you act like you're against it, then you're going to get ejected from the fair. But yeah, anyone can go see those things. Anyone can go document them. Some of those things are free to enter. Some you have to pay a little bit of money. And I would put fairs, whether the county fairs or state fairs, I would put both those towards the top of the worst things I've ever seen. The level of abuse and violence at these places is ineffable. There's no words for it. It's just truly unbelievable, rather. You know, for example, one in next month in Pennsylvania, the PA Farm Show is coming around the corner, and they have the They call it the calf corner. They bring in 16, at least that's what they did in 2024. They bring in 16 pregnant cows who have been destined to produce babies in front of an audience at this fair. And they straight up lie to the public about, because they take the babies away from the moms within 20 to 30 minutes. Which is, you know, what they do on the actual farms too, except on the actual farms, sometimes the calves don't even have 20 or 30 minutes. Sometimes it's immediate if someone's around when it's at when the birth takes place. But yeah, they take the babies away and they lie to the public about how the mothers have no maternal instincts and how the baby's better with us, and that if the baby was left with the mom might kill the baby or injure the baby. And the lies just go on and on and on. And 'cause the dairy industry knows that more people are finding out now how dairy works. It used to be the case that no one knew, not nobody, but mostly nobody knew that you had to impregnate a cow against her will so that she would have a baby, and then what would follow is they would produce milk. So now that there's a lot more people like us telling the public that this is how dairy works, they have to level up their transparency and let people know that that's how it works too. But they have to humane wash it and act like it's all done kindly, benevolently, and it's for, you know, it's for the cow's own good to take them away from their mother. And this is becoming a popular thing at fairs. It's not happening at the majority of fairs, but it's happening at a lot of them all over the country. It's completely disturbing. So that's just one example. And then the 4-H and FFA shows, and you know, the list goes on and on and on. But I would, if anyone's listening to this and they're interested in, you know, documenting any atrocities happening to animals, I would definitely encourage them to start with things like fairs. Because most of us live near fairs, they're very accessible, and there's a wide variety of things happening to animals at these places. And Most fairs have never really been covered from an animal rights perspective because there's too many of them and there's not enough, vegans or vegans who are documenting things. And not that like documenting something means that something's going to change, but it's still good to put something out there and raise awareness about injustices that are taking place in our backyards.
Yes, and I will personally take those words to heart. I know in summer there are a few, rodeo fairs around where I live. So yes, I will definitely be thinking about what you just said,
Awesome.
and maybe listen back to this episode to give me some courage to go and try to document. And also, what do they call them? Tips, I think. If people have some information, like insider information, or they want to make you aware of some particularly atrocious things going on somewhere, how can they reach you? How can they message you?
They could send me either a direct message on my Instagram, which is unparalleled underscore suffering. I do have a Facebook that you can technically message me on as well, but I rarely ever engage with my Facebook. I can go months in a row without even sharing anything to my Facebook. I've almost completely lost interest in that app, which is nothing recent. This has been going on for years. Sometimes I question if I should even still have it. So that's one way. And then you can also email me at photographer@unparalleledsuffering.org.
And again, please refer to the episode's notes for all of that. And thank you again for all your great work. Thank you for having taken the time to meet with me and answer my questions. This was really appreciated.
Thank you for the opportunity, and it's an honor to be featured on my favorite vegan podcast to date. So, thank you.
Thank you for that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.